Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, doctors find an unconventional way to treat severe valley fever. It's the extraordinary story of a four-year-old boy and a medical mystery. And writer Lisa Lee Herrick tells us how the Hmong New Year has evolved from a traditional harvest celebration to something much bigger, and why Fresno's festivities continue to draw huge international crowds. We also hear from Fresno mayoral candidate Andrew Jantz. But first, a quick look at this week's news. Governor Gavin Newsom was in Fresno Wednesday to announce $11.5 million in emergency grants to combat homelessness in the county. A poll released this week by the Public Policy Institute of California finds Californians want state leaders to address homelessness above all else. Also in Fresno, Grizzly Fest won't return to the city this summer. Event organizers posted on Instagram that the popular music festival is on hold while negotiations with the city continue. And in Bakersfield, 18 months of legal troubles facing Kern County Supervisor Leticia Perez ended yesterday with a court settlement. Perez faced misdemeanor charges for alleged financial conflicts of interest. The conditions of the settlement include 100 hours of community service and payment of $30,000 to charitable organizations. According to the press release from the DA's office, the charges against Perez will be dismissed if she meets the court's conditions within 1 year. Also in Bakersfield, a Facebook post by State Senator Shannon Grove made headlines this week. The post showed the risque table of contents of a sex education book that Grove incorrectly claimed was part of the state's curriculum. I spoke with Bakersfield, Californian columnist Robert Price about this controversy and its fallout. And a warning, this conversation contains some sexually explicit language. Okay, so give us the backstory. How did this post come to your attention?
Well, someone alerted me that State Senator Grove had posted a photo from a table of contents of a manuscript. We don't know, didn't know immediately what it was, but it was a table of contents that listed some sexual practices, some known and some not well as well known, some I had never heard of. But she
and maybe you could share with our listeners some of the titles.
Well, there was anal sex. There was also something called body fluid or blood play. There was kinky sex. There were sex toys. There was, a number of things that
provocative stuff.
Provocative things. And the caption that Senator Grove put under that was, "So this is what our California sex ed curriculum looks like, and for this we can thank Democrats who don't care about our children and so on and so forth." She was almost immediately outed by people who recognized it as not being part of the curriculum. And in fact, it was a manuscript written by a writer in Chicago. It was considered for a time as part of a supplementary reading list to the state curriculum, and it was ultimately rejected after some public comment, along with some other books. And so it was never part of the curriculum. And it was part of an effort, I think, on her part to support a bill by State Senator Mike Morello Branch of Cucamonga, SB 673, which came before the Education Committee yesterday in Sacramento. And it was voted down 5-2. So SB 673 is no more. But I think that was part of the frenzy, perhaps, that led her to post that ill-advisedly.
And I understand she's since come out and apologized.
She came out today and she said, "I'm sorry, I got this from a source that I thought was reliable, and I shouldn't have done it." I should note, by the way, that it was that book was pulled from the suggested reading list 8 months ago. So how it came to her attention after all this time is, beyond me.
But there, you mentioned in your column that this table of contents had been circulated on some other sites. It had been lurking on the internet for a while.
It has been, yeah. There was something, there's a group called Concerned Parents of Washington that posted the same photograph with some of the same information about a week ago. And then it was picked up by a kind of an ultra-conservative news, unquote, website called National File. And so I don't know if that's where she got it or not, but it was published on that website just the day before she posted on Facebook. But the Facebook, actually, fact checkers for Facebook, yes, they do exist, went into the Concerned Parents of Washington Facebook page and blocked that particular entry, saying it was not factual.
So what is the lesson here for all of us? I'm sure many of the people listening, myself included, have posted things on Facebook and then subsequently learned that they were not accurate. What should we be doing to avoid getting ourselves in this situation?
Well, I think we all have a heightened sense of responsibility. We are all the media. If we're on social media, we have an incredible reach that we may not be even aware of. In Senator Groh's case, I mean, she has many thousands of followers, and of course people can share and so forth. So, I mean, you have this unlimited reach. I think as consumers of news, we all have a responsibility to be skeptical. And if we're posting things, it's even more heightened, I think, the responsibility. It's really easy to check some of this stuff out and find out, you know, is it true? What's the level of confidence we should have? That's a responsibility we all need to take more seriously, I think.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Sure thing. Thanks.
Thanks.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Every year, thousands of Californians contract the fungal disease Valley fever. And in rare cases, the disease spreads throughout the body. It can be debilitating and sometimes fatal. Why people respond so differently to the fungus has puzzled experts for decades. But as FM89's Carrie Klein reports, a new case out of UCLA may help shed some light on a new path forward.
Hundreds of kids and their families cycle in and out of UCLA's Mattel Children's Hospital every week. But Dr. Manish Butte still remembers the day almost 2 years ago that he met a young boy who could barely walk or talk and needed a feeding tube to eat.
We saw these very large lumps on his forehead, and the lumps were full of fungal infection, and they were burrowing through the bones of his skull.
4-year-old Abraham Gonzalez Martinez was suffering a life-threatening case of Valley fever, also known as coccidioidomycosis or COCCY. The disease typically infects the lungs, but in rare cases, it can spread into the nervous system and bones.
He was desperately ill. He was on multiple antifungal medicines, top doses of everything, and the infection was still spreading.
Butte is a pediatric immunologist and a founder of UCLA's Center for Rare Diseases. It's a team that takes on the hardest-to-solve cases, like severe autoimmune diseases and genetic mutations, and pours all their energy into figuring them out. In that way, Butte's a bit like Dr. House, that TV doctor from the early 2000s who saves a life in every episode by unraveling medical puzzles. He's also a grouch.
Thank you so much. I gotta get you a gift or something.
Sometimes the best gift is the gift of never seeing you again.
Okay, all right.
Butte, on the other hand, is extremely personable, but he says he gets the comparison a lot.
Yes. I hope I'm not as abusive and mean as Dr. House is, but yes, in this clinic, we only do mystery cases. So in that way, there's a lot of parallels with the show.
Abraham had originally gone to a hospital near Santa Barbara, but the disease was so stubborn and moving so fast, doctors sent him to the medical sleuths at UCLA.
We were going full court press to try to save him.
Severe COCCY isn't unheard of, but Abraham didn't fall into any groups at high risk of the disease. There was also no local outbreak. And so some doctors might have diagnosed tough luck. But Butte, he didn't buy it. He wondered maybe there was an error in Abraham's immune system. To investigate, he brought in backup, Dr. Maria Garcia Uret, another pediatric immunologist at UCLA.
Neither Manish and I, or I, we always say that we don't believe in bad luck.
Instead, they believe there's always a reason the immune system breaks.
That's the starting point. The, you know, is to be convinced that there's got to be something here. Again, that bad luck is just a surrogate for lack of knowledge.
And maybe, they thought, if they could find that knowledge for Abraham, his case could help others. So Bude, Garcia, Ured, and their team got to work.
This is called a flow sorter.
A lot of that took place outside Abraham's body in the Bute lab. Part clinic, part research space, it has some of the most high-tech tools available anywhere. Flow cytometers to sort cells, super sensitive microscopes to manipulate them.
We actually physically touch the cells and measure molecules on the cells by touch and by sight.
Armed with these, the team studied Abraham's DNA and counted, sorted, and observed his white blood cells, the front lines of the immune system.
We stimulate them and poke them and prod them to make sure their function is working the way we think. And then we sequence the genome to try to understand what genes there are and if they're broken.
They didn't find any genetic defects, so they zeroed in on Abraham's T cells, immune cells that fight off infection and disease. The immune system programs T cells into two main classes, which battle different kinds of threats. And this is where things get interesting. Bute found Abraham's T cells had been programmed to fight the wrong threat, one that wasn't even in his system, kind of like sending a SWAT team into an empty building.
The rest of his immune system was telling his T cells, hey, we're fighting a fungus today. And the T cells weren't listening. They were instead focused on fighting a parasite.
But he thought maybe the T cells could be reprogrammed. And that's when the doctors finally started building momentum. Garcia Ured suggested a drug for immune disorders. It promotes the T cell program Abraham needed. And it worked, sort of.
He was getting better, you know. We were reasonably satisfied, but when we kept on looking at the lesions in the head and in the back, nothing was being resolved, fully resolved.
Still, too many of Abraham's cells were running the wrong program. By this time, he'd been in a hospital bed for months. Garcia Ured kept thinking back to a 17-year-old girl she'd heard about years ago, whose valley fever had landed her in intensive care.
Slowly but surely, she ended up dying in the ICU. And I heard about that case, again, like 10 years ago or a little bit more, and he never left me.
She couldn't bear to let that happen to the 4-year-old boy in front of her. So she dug around and found another drug, a brand new one also meant for immune disorders. As far as they know, it had never before been used on Coxty. They tested it first in Abraham's cells in the lab, then in his body, and bingo.
We saw that his skull bones were all healing. And you could see immediately that all the lumps of fungal infection in his body were fading away.
It took a few more months, but those lumps and lesions shrank, then finally disappeared. Abraham started eating, started playing. He talked more and sang for his nurses.
Seeing that he was getting better was a joy for all of us.
That final drug they tried is just a few years old. It's meant for two disorders completely unrelated to fungal diseases, asthma and eczema. But it works by calming the part of Abraham's immune system that had gone haywire.
It actually turned out to be one of those eureka moments.
All in all, Abraham spent 11 months in the hospital. He was released in early 2019. And today, he's back for a checkup.
What is your favorite food?
Pizza.
Mine too!
I'll bring you more of Abraham's story in just a minute.
I'm Robert Blackwood. I am 60 years old.
I'm Marquita Cooper.
My name is Nicole Saunders.
Hello, my name is Austin Franklin. I'm 24 years old.
We're StoryCorps, a nonprofit organization, and we've spent 15 years recording people all over the country having meaningful conversations. Invite someone you know to visit our mobile booth to listen to their stories and share some of your own.
In partnership with Valley Public Radio, reservations will be available starting January 29th at StoryCorps.org.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. You've just heard about medical mystery solvers at UCLA who treated Abraham, a young boy with life-threatening valley fever. His case offered a rare glimpse into how the immune system can mismanage the disease. FM89's Kerry Klein steps back into Abraham's story to show that his case may also have been the start of something even bigger.
You're a good boy, thank you, Abraham.
Today, nearly a year after being discharged from the hospital, Abraham is back at UCLA for a checkup. The now six-year-old is not a fan of the needle coming at him by a nurse.
I know.
Abraham's valley fever isn't gone, but it's managed. His mom still injects him with a cocktail of drugs, and the nurse today is measuring how his body responds to Coxie.
And I'm going to get you some toys, okay?
No, we need some toys.
Okay.
A tiny boy in Batman socks and a Paw Patrol t-shirt, Abraham is smiley and sweet, but painfully shy. Even though he charmed the hospital with his playfulness and singing voice, today a nutritionist can barely get one word out of him at a time.
What is your favorite food?
Pizza.
Pizza. Mine too!
The fact that he's speaking English at all is a feat. He and his mother arrived at UCLA speaking only Mixteco, an indigenous language of Mexico. But over his 11 months in the hospital, he picked up bits and pieces of both English and Spanish.
You know, everybody at the hospital misses you. But we're glad you're home.
During that time, Abraham was practically raised by hospital staff. His mother, Magdalena Gonzalez, is a strawberry picker in Santa Maria. She was lucky if she could take just one day a week to travel the 300 miles round trip to visit him.
Yes, it's difficult because sometimes I can't find any transportation to come here.
She learned some Spanish, too. Dr. Maria Garcia Lloret, who you met earlier in the show, says Gonzalez grew right alongside her son, managing his many prescriptions, his pharmacists, and doctors. All this, she says, Gonzalez did without a driver's license or being able to read or write in any language.
Having a patient like him, you know, with a chronic illness and so many medications is a challenge. And she's gained my respect and my admiration.
Abraham seems blissfully unaware of just how ill he was, or how important he's been to Valley Fever research. He benefited from what's called precision medicine, which uses each patient's unique circumstances and genetic code to develop personalized treatment.
It's an unusual case for anywhere. Very few patients, unfortunately, get the kind of extraordinary evaluation and care that this child received.
Dr. Royce Johnson is medical lead of the Valley Fever Institute at Kern Medical in Bakersfield. Having treated hundreds of patients with severe disease, he's long been interested in why people respond so differently to it and whether the answer could lurk somewhere in the body. In Abraham's case, it was in the immune system.
I've wondered about this for years and years, but we didn't have the technology to really try and answer the question until relatively recently.
But could such resource-intensive care ever be possible for the thousands of new patients each year? Without hesitating, Johnson says yes, someday. So does Dr. Paul Krogstad, a pediatric infectious disease specialist at UCLA. He treated Abraham alongside the doctors you met earlier. A Valley Fever expert, Krogstad says Abraham was a test case, and later patients should only become easier.
If you improve the science so that you can figure out what the needs are, you often can reduce, actually, the complexity of care that's required.
And the cost. To that end, a team of doctors, including those you heard from here, are launching a new project to study the immune systems of 50 Valley Fever patients in nearly as much detail as they studied Abraham's.
To potentially do, as we're attempting to in this specific case, to help a person recover and have a shorter course of Valley Fever by helping intensify the immune system by refocusing it.
Someday, they may even be able to predict early on how bad someone's symptoms could become. The project is partially inspired by Abraham, though it was in the works before he appeared at UCLA, and it's thanks to an influx of state funding into Coxie research. After decades of slow progress, Krogstad says it's exciting to see rising interest in the disease.
We simply haven't seen it sufficient attention paid to this condition, and I'm afraid it has just looked like a regional problem that didn't require special attention.
Plus, Abraham's case caught the eye of Big Pharma. The companies that produced his immune drugs confirmed they're talking with UCLA about possible clinical trials on more Valley Fever patients. In the coming months, Abraham's doctors plan to start weaning him off his many drugs. They hope someday he'll be done with them for good.
What's your favorite color today?
Red.
And what's your favorite animal?
Flamingo.
Flamingo, that's so cool.
Abraham, though, he just wants to think about normal kid things. Flamingos, iPad games, and of course, pizza. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
This story was produced as part of the Just One Breath Reporting Collaborative, an innovative reporting venture housed at the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism. The music you just heard was by Kevin MacLeod. And now Carrie is with me here in the studio. So, Carrie, these are fascinating stories. Thank you for covering them. I know you've reported on this disease for several years now, and it sounds like from your stories that momentum is finally building in terms of Valley Fever research.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this is something that researchers and scientists have been telling me for quite some time. But I really saw a glimpse of it myself when I went to a Valley Fever Summit at UC Merced back in October. And at that time, I think the organizers weren't quite sure what to expect in terms of turnout, but more than 100 scientists, doctors, survivors, students, they all came in, poured in from around the state. The excitement in the room was palpable. A group of them even stayed for an hour afterward just to chat and kind of learn about each other.
Wow.
So, yeah, there was this air of collaboration and interest. And that was notable because even just a few years ago when I first began reporting on this disease, you could not have found that many people with expertise in the disease, much less, you know, interest in learning more about it. So someone who really articulated this to me is Katrina Hoyer. She's an immunologist at UC Merced who focuses on Valley Fever there. And she said that in the 7 years that she's been studying this disease, the research field has transformed.
So a lot of new faces now at the conferences. I've seen an increase in the numbers of people that are attending them, and also a huge increase in the diversity of scientists that are attending the conferences. So all of that, I think, is really good and is going to really help us make some breakthroughs in the next few years.
So what's changed? What's brought on more interest?
The short answer is funding. It's not a ton, but it's good seed funding, as Hoyer described it to me. So in 2018, outgoing Governor Jerry Brown set aside $8 million from his state budget for the disease, and $6 million of that went to research. Now, that was only 2 years ago. It's very recent in the research world, but much of that has already been directed toward new projects and new collaborations. And so Dr. Manish Butte, who you heard in the story earlier, he knew practically nothing about Valley Fever before taking on Abraham's case in 2018. And now he's involved in a research project among four different institutions using this new funding to study the immune systems of 50 patients with Valley Fever.
So, Carrie, can you break down where that $8 million from Governor Brown has gone?
Yeah. So $2 million of it went to the state public health department for outreach and education. They say they've put together some PSAs and some social media messages. $3 million went to the Valley Fever Institute at Kern Medical in Bakersfield. That is a new institute, but the medical director there, Dr. Royce Johnson, he's one of the longtime experts in the disease. And most of that $3 million has been put toward an actual brick-and-mortar clinic so they can actually see Valley Fever patients in a setting that's not a hospital. Plus, they've got a handful of new scientific studies going on. And the remaining $3 million went to the University of California system. And that's where these two big new research projects are housed. There's the one that I mentioned that looks at immune dysregulation among Valley Fever patients. And the other project will be a big sweeping overview of knowledge gaps and research needs related to the disease.
So money is what's making the difference. But how did the funding even come about?
The short answer to that might be as simple as politics. So there are two assemblymen in Kern County, Rudy Salas and Vince Fong, who have long been interested in the disease, and they've introduced a lot of bills related to it. Salas, in particular, advocated hard for this funding. But some also argue that interest really began to rise way before that. Here is Dr. Paul Krogstad. You also heard from him in the story. He's at UCLA. And he's here talking about South Valley Congressman Kevin McCarthy.
Well, I really think that the turning point was the 2014 conference held in Bakersfield, organized by the congressman, who made sure that it was attended by the head of the Center for Disease Control and by the head of the National Institutes of Health, who heard firsthand from the community in Bakersfield of the impact of this condition on their lives.
That conference was actually in 2013, not 2014. But many people still mention this meeting to me today as being pivotal in bringing Valley Fever to a wider, more national audience. And finally, just last fall, McCarthy actually helped secure more funding for the CDC in the 2020 budget. That's $2 million there, particularly for the office that deals with fungal diseases like Valley Fever.
Wow. Well, thank you, Carrie, for bringing us these stories.
Yeah, thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. California's primary is March 3rd. In the studio to discuss his campaign strategy and vision for Fresno is mayoral candidate Andrew Janz. He's facing former Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer. Well, thank you for being with us today, first of all. I'd like to talk about the campaign right off the bat. So we've got less than 2 months to go now before the election. What is your strategy, especially given the fact that you've kept a relatively low public profile compared to your opponent? I know your strategy was different than his, and I'm just curious, in this final stretch, are we going to see any changes in your strategy?
You know, we have 50 days to go, and I'm out there on the campaign trail every day, so I don't agree with those people out there that say that I'm not out campaigning. He's actually gone into hiding in the last couple of months, and he's being very selective, picking and choosing which places to interview. We've been struggling to do a joint interview with the Fresno Bee. That's been a challenge. He's walked away from a leadership council forum organized by Faith in the Valley. And so we've made a concerted effort to go everywhere to speak to the entire community. I've been on conservative radio. I've been on progressive radio stations. I accept every invitation to debate or go to a forum. I've had 3 town halls in the last 3 months. We are on track to do a town hall in every single city council district in the city of Fresno. We've had hundreds of people come out to our town halls. And if you're following us on social media, we're very active and engaged, which is sort of the new playing field for politics in this century. So in the next 50 days, what we need to do is increase voter turnout. This race is going to come down to turnout. And this is a nonpartisan race, but everybody knows that I am the progressive in the race, the Democrat. Everyone knows that he's the Republican, the Trump supporter in the race. And the city of Fresno has a voter registration advantage for progressives, 17 points, 33,000 more registered Democrats than Republicans. And so it's going to be a large-scale get-out-the-vote effort amongst my campaign and the constituency group supporting my race.
So let's talk about some of the specifics of your strategy for the city. Where are your priorities when it comes to budget? I'm curious what a Janz budget will look like compared to a Lee Brand budget.
Well, let me talk a little bit about budgets. I have a pretty good background in terms of budgets. In my early 20s, I was a president and CEO of a nonprofit organization that towards the end of my term had close to a $2 million budget. I was selected by my university's president to sit on his budget oversight committee. That was a $100 million budget. During the peak of the recession, we had to make some very important tough cuts to staffing positions and things like that. And so I've got that background in terms of handling budgets. To me, the most important thing about budgeting is transparency. The voters need to know where their funds are going. And right now, what we've seen at City Hall is a complete lack of funding for the things that people really care about in terms of parks, senior centers and the arts and all of the great things that will make our community more vibrant. And so to answer your question, how does a Janz budget look different from a Lee Brand budget? We're going to have more money for parks. We're going to have more money for public safety in terms of creating an accountable police force, community-based policing, and then also for fire protection. And so I'm one of the folks that is going to be pushing for what I'm calling right now a Parks 2.0. The Parks measure failed in the last cycle. We're going to have another opportunity in 2020. We think that we're going to be able to get it on the ballot for November. And so me and other stakeholders in the community, folks at BHC, folks at the Central Valley Foundation. All of us are getting behind this initiative, and we think that we can get enough votes to pass this time around. And that's something that I'm going to be supporting.
Great. Let's move on to homelessness. You have said in the past that you thought it was a mistake when the city got rid of its homeless encampments. I'd like for you to unpack that. Why? Explain your thinking and really tell us what your plan is to tackle this incredibly complex issue.
It is a complex issue, and my criticism of them going in and demolishing the homeless encampment was really aimed at the fact that they didn't have a plan in place to manage the people that we were going to displace from it. I understand that there were issues in terms of safety and sanitation, but those are issues that we could have addressed outside of completely demolishing that location. And so for me, there are multiple aspects to this problem. Number one, we need to do a better job of prevention. There are people that are right on the cusp of being homeless. And if you look at other cities around the country, there are programs in place in major cities that allow local governments to step in and help people who are maybe having a bad month, because most people are just one paycheck away from losing everything that they have. So we got to do a better job in terms of prevention. In the short term, the city has to do more in terms of putting the resources behind this issue. And I've been one of the people that's been out there, Assemblymember Joaquin Arambula, Ashley Swearingen. We've been out there calling on the governor to help us in terms of creating funding opportunities to create shelters and all of the good things that we know that we need to put roofs over people's heads. And so this past week, we've seen in the governor's budget $90 million. Much of that money is going to go to affordable housing and tackling the poverty issue. Long term, we need to make sure that we work better with the county to provide the resources that we know that are needed in terms of behavioral health, in terms of drug addiction. But our country needs to have a conversation about income inequality, where we have right now the top 1% of earners in our country controlling over half of the nation's resources in terms of wealth.
Which is certainly an issue, but not something you could tackle from the...
It's not a local issue, but I think that the mayor should use that soapbox to go after the issue of poverty, and I intend to do that as mayor.
Great. So whoever wins this election is going to play a central role in the selection of a new police chief. You've talked about the process in the past. What I'm curious about is, what do you want to see from the next police chief? What qualities or what experiences do you think are going to be important for the next person who fills that position?
Well, we need an ethical police chief. The last police chief that we had was a police chief for 18 years and engaged in politics, I think at the expense of the department. This was a police chief that had been sued as a department and personally for things like racial and gender discrimination. His second in command is now serving 4 years in federal prison for narcotics trafficking right under the police chief's nose. So we need a police chief that is going to be ethical, transparent, and somebody that's going to be a good steward of taxpayer dollars. We've spent over the last 18 years over $30 million in paying out lawsuits related to his malfeasance at the Fresno Police Department. And now he wants us to turn over the keys to running the city. The city of Fresno cannot afford another 4 years of Jerry Dyer. And so the next police chief has to believe that there's an issue in terms of criminal justice reform. I want somebody that's going to be able to come in and clean shop and boost the morale there. I work in public safety as a prosecutor, and I talk to many of the police officers there. Favoritism runs rampant. If you don't attend the right social gatherings, if you don't befriend the right people, you don't get promoted. And so there's a culture there that needs to be completely changed. And that is going to be one of my top priorities as the next mayor. The next mayor will pick the next police chief, not Lee Brand.
So what do you see as the relationship the mayor should have with local education institutions, K-12 and higher education? What can, what should a mayor do in order to improve educational outcomes and increase access to educational opportunities?
You know, several years ago, our former mayor, Alan Autry, tried to be a little bit more engaged when it came to education policy, and voters pushed back on that. So I understand the history there, and I have to respect sort of the will of the voters when it comes to that. But that doesn't mean that there needs to be a complete separation between the two. And I think you're kind of alluding to this. There needs to be coordination between what the mayor's doing and what the school board is doing. And that is going to be part of my plan to refocus resources in creating healthy neighborhoods. We can only create healthy neighborhoods if there's adequate funding for education. And so I'm glad to see that in Sacramento under the previous administration, and I think under this administration, education is a key component of what they're doing. We have begun having conversations in terms of how we dole out dollars for education funding at the local level. You know, we have some of the highest funded schools in our community, and we have some of the least funded schools. And so that disparity, we need to close. Fresno has a very bad track record in terms of the high school to prison pipeline. In terms of racial inequality, we rank 59 out of 59 in terms of large cities in California in terms of this inequality. And so education is absolutely a key to that. And so I want to develop a better relationship than we have now between the city and the school board.
So you work downtown. You have obviously been there to see the changes that downtown has experienced since the opening of Fulton Street. I'm wondering, are you pleased with the progress?
I think that we've made good progress since we've implemented the new master plan back in 2014, but we can do better. It is still very difficult for the city to get developers and investors to invest in downtown Fresno. And there's a number of reasons for that. And so as mayor, I want to make sure that we reduce the red tape that allows people to come in and fund projects, to have restaurants. I'm very critical of the current administration and letting the soccer team go. We should have done a lot more to keep them here. We didn't do enough. And so we need to make sure that especially downtown and the corridors that lead into downtown, we need to make sure that we continue to fund and promote business opportunities for people that want to turn the city around. I'm completely against what we've seen in the last 20 years. We are continually pushing the boundaries of Fresno to the exterior. Urban sprawl is run rampant. And so my priority is to focus resources on existing neighborhoods that have been ignored for an entire generation.
And what are you going to do with those resources? What's the plan?
Here's the thing. So there are a number of organizations and people right now that have put forward a roadmap to where we need to go. The DRIVE initiative is a perfect example of that. We have a large cross-section of our community that's come together around this proposal. The governor's office has actually recognized the DRIVE initiative in his latest allocation of $90 million to the city of Fresno and the outlying areas. And so there's already a plan, a very specific plan in place on what we need to do in terms of funding all of the things that we need to fund. And so I would direct your listeners to the DRIVE initiative. You can look it up online, and it's a very detailed roadmap of where we're going to go, and that's the roadmap that I'm going to follow.
So since we're downtown, let's talk high-speed rail. What are your thoughts? How does that fit into this larger conversation?
Yeah, I'm a big supporter of high-speed rail. Many of your listeners will remember in my last race when I ran for Congress, it was a big talking point amongst the two campaigns. But I think that it has been very difficult for California to sort of shoulder that project on its own. I've always been a big proponent of getting the federal government involved. Long-term, I think we're going to have a new Senate, a new Congress in 2021. I think we're going to have a new president. One of the first things they need to take up from the federal side of things is investing in America, investing in infrastructure. I think both parties agree that we need to rebuild our country. So we need a mayor that's going to be out there to be a champion for these big projects to come here to Fresno. I want to create a situation where people outside of our city limits understand that we're open for business. And so I'm going to be very aggressive in going after state and federal dollars to make sure big projects like high-speed rail are fully funded. It's going to create a ton of jobs and a lot of opportunity for people.
So last week on Valley Edition, we ran a story on the Tulare County city of Woodlake, which has generated over $800,000 in tax revenue through cannabis businesses. I'm curious, what is your stance on recreational marijuana sales in Fresno?
I've been a longtime supporter of recreational marijuana, and it, I think, stems a lot from my experience in working in public safety as a prosecutor and seeing that the war on drugs and really the war on cannabis has really not worked. This is a huge investment opportunity for the city of Fresno. Conservative estimates say that we're going to make, as a city, $500,000 a year on sales tax revenue from cannabis. I think it's going to be closer to $1 million. And so I've been a big proponent of making sure that we have a safe, regulated, and legal industry here in the city of Fresno. My opponent has flip-flopped on this issue. Nobody knows where he stands. We were on conservative talk radio where he was completely against the legalization of marijuana, but then in front of a GV Wire debate, he said that he was in favor of it. You know, folks in the cannabis industry are confused. You know, we're meeting with them. I think both campaigns are meeting with them to sort of lay out a roadmap of where we're going to go from here. And behind closed doors, he's telling them that that he's in favor of it, but then publicly he's against it. So, you know, it's really mixed messages, and this is the only issue that he's flip-flopped on. But under a Jans administration, the direction will be clear. We're going to have legalized cannabis in the city of Fresno, and we're going to do it safely. We're going to protect children, and we're going to use the sales tax revenue to fund projects that we desperately need here.
So speaking of children, you have one on the way.
Yes. Little baby girl. Doctors are telling us any day now.
Well, congratulations to you and your wife.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for being with us today. We really appreciate you taking the time.
It's my pleasure.
And we have also reached out to Jerry Dyer and his team several times for an interview, but they have not responded to our request.
The Secret War disrupted the patrilineage that formed the foundation of Hmong cultural identity and its clans. Nearly 25% of Hmong men and boys, or an estimated 30,000 to 40,000 Hmong soldiers, were killed in action, and up to 3,000 named missing in action.
That's writer Lisa Lee Herrick, reading from her recent essay, Eating 30 in Fresno, Finding Home at Hmong New Year, in the online publication Boom California. Herrick talks with FM89's news director Alice Daniel about why so many Hmong refugees came to Fresno after the CIA's secret war in Laos under the guidance of their leader, General Vang Pao, and why decades later, the city's Hmong New Year is still a global draw.
Your article in Boom California pays homage to the resilience of the Hmong people, their ability to sustain this sense of identity through clan and kinship ties, despite being scattered around the world. And it sounds like from your writing that the Hmong New Year Festival in Fresno not only exemplifies, but is also sort of the center of that resourcefulness. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So for a lot of Hmong Americans living in Fresno, California, you know, a lot of the grassroots political movements, a lot of the social services, a lot of the religious community here, and in fact, I would say pretty much all Hmong Americans who have come here by way of allegiance and working with General Vang Pao. And Fresno became his sort of his home base, in a sense, because there are so many military veterans groups that were started here that were founded and staffed by his family, still continue to be. And a lot of them made their residence here. So it was just really an easy way to access him, to find leadership. In a way, he was a liaison between the Hmong community and the federal government, especially for those of us who came here to this country completely by random. It was a lottery system. So many Hmong refugees, when they first came to America, had never really heard anyone speak English. Many of us didn't know how to read. Those of us who were educated and literate were very few and far in between. But for the most part, the majority of refugees, Hmong refugees from Laos, were farmers with a very, very, very minimal education. And Fresno was just, it was a great fit because Fresno is a very agricultural community, but it's also extremely urban. A lot of Hmong could still farm. But the Fresno Fairgrounds was really crucial because having that space available to recreate a sort of temporary marketplace and venue where all Hmong could gather and be enclosed and see each other and just really interact the way that it happened in Laos was a great, great benefit to the community here.
And your own family moved from Merced to Fresno in 1992 and, of course, every year went to the Hmong New Year. It didn't always sit that well with you as a teenager, right? You felt like you didn't fit in all the time. You were taller. Your skin was darker from summer harvest work. You found ways to rebel, including dyeing your hair red or wearing harsh eyeliner or a jean jacket scrawled with anarchy signs. Could you read a bit from your piece, the part that describes the sort of tension between you and your more traditional mother?
Sure, absolutely. When I was a teenager, the last thing I wanted to do during my winter break from high school was to dress up for Hmong New Year in my mother's heavy, musty, hand-embroidered hemp clothing from her trousseau. I was a milk-fed American girl who ate cheeseburgers and fries nearly every weekday for lunch, so at 16, I was already whiter and thicker than my mother, who was petite and fine-boned at 5'4" and shrinking. Dressing up for the Hmong New Year was a multi-step process that can only be described as attempting to put on all of your formal wear at once while pinning the money from your wallet to every square inch of fabric available, a must for good Hmong daughters to prove to potential suitors and mother-in-laws at Hmong New Year that you were wife material. First, there was the black velvet jacket worn over a white, collared, button-down shirt, which was then wrapped around the waist using two thin cords. The seams of my hand-stitched jacket bulged and groaned against my widening back with each passing year, and I felt the pins and needles in my fingertips as the peacock blue cuffs coiled tighter and tighter around my meaty forearms. "Why are your breasts so big?" my mother sighed, smacking my chest. "Are you wearing a bra or not?" "Mom!" I whined. Next came the heavy, pleated hemp skirt. My paternal grandmother's was dyed black with white trim and cross-stitched with bright pink, orange, green, and turquoise threads, symbolizing the Hmong's journey over valleys and mountains to reach Laos, because she was a member of the Green Hmong tribe. My mother's skirt was plain and white, because she was a member of the White Hmong tribe, and she wrapped this around my hips with two long sashes. The skirt flared open in front like a hospital gown worn backwards, and my mother sucked at her teeth. "Ayah, your butt's too big for Hmong clothes," she said. "If I had known that you girls would grow as big as cows in America, I would have bought more fabric." "What? Why are you making that ugly face?"
It's a fantastic description. Thank you. The contemporary Hmong New Year is very different from past traditional celebrations in Laos or China. It sounds like it's evolved in the past from marking the end of the harvest season to clan leaders now drawing on their military skills or expertise to Americanize the festival. Can you talk a little bit more about the differences sort of pre and post 1975 in terms of the Hmong New Year?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Hmong New Year, first of all, is kind of a misnomer because in our community we call it Nao Peikyo, which means to eat the 30, as in 30 days. Coming from our agricultural roots, you spend the majority of the year farming, sowing seeds, tending your crops, fattening up your pigs and your cows, feeding your chickens. So at the end of the year, when the harvest is good and a cow has been slaughtered, that's the one time of the year that everyone basically pigs out for 30 days. Everyone eats as much as they want. It's also a great excuse. It's like a huge dinner party for the village. It's also a good excuse to invite other people from other villages to say, "Come on over, let's celebrate, let's eat together." With that format, it was more about family reunions. It was more about being able to relax for once. Whereas now, you'll see that the Hmong New Year is, I wouldn't quite say it's quite commercialized yet, but it's definitely adapted to contemporary Hmong American tastes. So the Hmong New Year now is more of a proper festival. There are lots of programs and activities. There are songs and dances and concerts, the Hmong Beauty Pageant. Also, vendors pay money to appear there. And especially this year, I saw a great diversity of vendors. We had a Korean American church. We had Chicanx vendors sending churros, pickles, and burritos. We had a lot of entrepreneurs setting up shop for websites, for clothing lines, and fusion cuisines. So it's really becoming a true marketplace, which is really different from its original beginnings. It's very humble beginnings.
And the cultural centerpiece remains the Miss Hmong Beauty Queen. It was a program originally introduced at a military base in 1968 to boost Hmong soldiers' morale.
I believe so. According to the research I've read and a lot of secondhand knowledge from my parents, a lot of them do recall the Hmong Beauty Pageant initially was started to really just raise the morale of a lot of soldiers who had recently lost the Battle of Phupathi. It was a huge loss because that was where the radio towers were. So I think in order to kind of lift people's spirits up, they had a Hmong Beauty Pageant where the winner would basically be sort of the ambassador to the Hmong community. These days, though, I think the Hmong Beauty Pageants are a little bit more modern in that they've really taken a lot of their programming and choreography from, contemporary American pageants.
Hmm.
I think that in recent years, as you have second and third and fourth generation Hmong Americans coming up, I wouldn't quite call it criticism, but there are people raising their hands saying, is this still relevant? When I was a judge in 2017, it was one of the first years that the organizing groups had splintered into three groups. And so the Hmong cultural group decided to do the pageant this year because they won the bid for the Fresno Fairgrounds. And I think that their flexibility and their openness to changing the format really reflects a generational shift. And if it is a contemporary, program, and not necessarily an essential part of Hmong culture, I feel that that generational shift is okay.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the fact that you were a judge, and that was in 2017. Why don't you read us the section in your article where you explain your reaction to being asked to be a judge?
As a staunch feminist and reformed hippie punk artist with infrequently neon hair and frequently loud opinions, I sat stoically in my chair in front of the main stage at the inaugural Hmong Cultural New Year celebration. I wondered if I was now part of a new vanguard of second and third generation cultural brokers, signifying that the Hmong American community was ready for new leadership. Did this mean that I was no longer the black sheep of the family? Was my appointment as a Miss Hmong USA Beauty Pageant Queen purely ironic? What did I really know about what an ideal Hmong woman was supposed to look, act, and sound like? I had eschewed my mother's nightly pandal lessons, preferring instead to run wild with the neighborhood boys in the woods and listen to grandfather's war stories. While the other Hmong girls in my parents' church had married young and helped on the family farm or lived at home while taking classes at community college, I had enrolled at the furthest school possible and only returned on holidays to debate politics, justice reform, public policy, and queer rights with my uncles over their beers. My hair changed with my moods from pink to red to purple and blue, and I left rainbow smears all over my mother's white pillows and towels that refused to wash out. I still enjoy arm wrestling with my male cousins. Did my appointment to influence the results of this year's beauty pageant reflect a sea change in gender norms for Hmong American women, or could I wag the dog in some minute capacity?
And what you found is that you could, in fact, wag the dog a little bit, right? You saw that the Hmong New Year festivities had changed quite a bit from when you last attended. Can you leave us with a few thoughts? How did you sort of square your past rebellion with your kind of current perspective?
Well, I have to say, first of all, that the judging was very unbiased because each judge was not allowed to discuss or meet the pageant contestants beforehand. I tried to be very thoughtful and purposeful with my notes and also stating that, for example, some of the contestants had talked about college and careers and wanting to be independent while still respecting their parents and their grandparents and their origin stories. So in my notes, I tried my best to really say, I applaud you for that. It's a burden, but it's a good burden. And I think that my small contributions there really help steer that community a little bit more. As far as the actual winners go, I feel that whoever wins it's a great honor to win. They're essentially being honored by their community. But as the beauty pageant does change, as dance choreographies become international, as clan names and clan affiliations become less important, I think that that just shows that we are truly becoming Americans in a sense that we are diverse within our own communities and we are able to, you know, really address those gaps. There's enough space for conversation now.
Well, Lisa Lee Herrick, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much, Alice.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, and Laura Satsui. Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.